CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 105 with Dr. Parag Majumdar, why you need an in-office surgery suite and how you can build it. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, my very special friend and special guest, Dr. Parag Majumdar from Chicago. How are you, Parag?
I'm doing well, Uday. Thanks for having me on.
What is new in your zoo?
Well, you know, a lot of things. I just found out last week that my daughter matched in ophthalmology, so we're over the moon.
Awesome.
To continue the legacy of our practice growth, which has seen a lot of family members join recently, and we're going to continue that trend, hopefully, in one more year when my second daughter applies to ophthalmology. So we're really excited for our growth phase of our practice.
Proud papa. I love it. I thought they were going to become professional golfers like you.
Well, I think golf pays a lot more money, but I think their heart is kind of where mine is, and they embraced this amazing field that we're blessed to be part of. And so I think they're going to make even more impacts than our generation was able to. So we're excited about that.
Oh, for sure. I think the new generation is amazing. Every year they get better and better.
It's amazing. And we always kind of joke and say that, you know, if I were applying to ophthalmology now, I would never get in. And that's probably true. But it's amazing how much sort of impact medical students are making even on our field, as I'm seeing this process evolve kind of firsthand over the last several years. Compared to when I was a medical student, I didn't really know much about ophthalmology. I kind of stumbled into it just by, you know, happenstance and luck. And thank God that I did. But now it's a very, very different situation. And we see these kids who are just so primed and they know so much about the field and they are so involved already. My daughter, who's a third year medical student now, she's already presented to AAO last year. And that's
wow.
Something that I didn't do until probably I was, you know, well into practice. And so we're seeing this sort of shift of how these kids are getting involved, and that bodes well for our future of our profession. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I think it's way more competitive. Like, if I applied to ophthalmology now, I'd be doing family practice. Let's put it that way.
Me and me both, probably. But now we're blessed. What a great field we have, and what a great impact we can make to our patients and our community. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's grown a lot in popularity. It's become exceedingly competitive.
Yes.
And so we see people getting involved really early. I've had college kids getting involved with research projects, let alone medical students. I, like you, I stumbled on it too. My fourth year of med school, I just happened to do an ophthalmology rotation or end of third year.
Yeah.
Just years.
Yeah, I was probably a little earlier. I got into it just because I was going to do ortho. I was an ortho bro my whole life, you know, sports and this and that. And through college, I worked in an athletic trainer's department, you know, taping up football players, you know, ankles and knees. And I was all into that. And then somebody just said, why don't you just do some, you know, research, or, you know, family friend who's an ophthalmologist. So I went down to Baltimore and I got introduced to Winnie Nirankari, who was a famous cornea specialist. I believe he may be retired by now, but he was quite a gem of a guy, and what an infectious, you know, love for ophthalmology, which I didn't understand. I thought that was unique. And now that I know, of course, in a minute, that everybody, all of us have that same sort of infectious love for ophthalmology. But that really kind of made such an impact on me at the time, and probably shaped my decision to do ophthalmology and then, of course, cornea later. And it's been a journey over the last, how many, 30 some years now. And so it's been incredible.
Well, the amazing thing is when you did cornea, and we're about the same age here, half the stuff didn't exist. There was no lamellar transplantation. It was all full thickness.
I always say, you know, I finished my residency in 97, and I tell my kids and other residents and fellows that, you know, I don't think there's one thing that I do in my practice today that I really learned in residency. Now, you can say, of course, because when we started, there was not much phaco. Where I was training, only one of our attendings was doing phaco. And so we started doing phaco, thank God. But, you know, and even that has changed, of course, so much.
I mean, course, yeah, pretty different.
Mind blowing. But not one thing that I do in my practice today, all the corneal lamellar procedures, all the refractive procedures, ICLs, SMILE, LASIK, cross link, all the things that we do, none of this was there. Medications that we use were not there. So this profession requires kind of lifelong commitment to learning and bettering yourself. And that's just, that's the speech that I just gave my daughter the other day. I said, look, you're going to be starting out here, and you need to make sure that for the next 30 years, you're always learning and always striving to do new things, growing as a person, growing as a surgeon, and you know, continuing to give back to your community and your patients and everybody. It's give back to your profession, which is really what this boils down to, is how can we make this next generation kind of, you know, even more successful than we were.
Yeah, I think they're definitely going to do it, obviously. They've got a commitment to lifelong learning, plus they have resources we never had.
Oh, no question.
I'm a few years younger. I finished residency in 2000. But I remember hunting for VHS tapes of Osher's video journal just so I could see people do surgery that weren't my endings. And now it's in high def on your phone anywhere on the planet.
Anytime you want. Yep, exactly. It's an amazing thing. And I think with that, you know, great power comes great responsibility. And I think they're going to have to sort of embrace that and really take this to even higher levels than we could have imagined.
Yeah, I have no doubt they'll do fine. Now, tell me about your practice, Chicago Cornea Consultants.
Yeah.
So you've been there basically forever.
Well, I started there, you know, and I was fortunate that, you know, I've had a few mentors in ophthalmology, you know, in residency. Ken Goins was my cornea mentor. That's probably the main reason why I went into cornea. And then my fellowship mentor, Randy Epstein, was the guy who was the driving force behind me getting into cornea and refractive surgery. I mean, he had such an amazing practice back at the time, and his dynamic personality. And it was an amazing fit for me. And I'm fortunate that the point of this is that I was able to get a job right out of fellowship with his practice. And he's been my partner now for, you know, 29 years or something like that. So I've been very, very fortunate and blessed to have had one job in my life. And our practice has evolved significantly. It's grown tremendously. As I mentioned, his daughter, Rachel Epstein, joined us a few years ago. My nephew, Neil Vadia, joined me in practice. He's my partner now, maybe 3-4 years ago as well. And we're looking forward to continuing to grow as we add more, you know, surgeons. And eventually down the road, maybe my daughters will join me in practice. That would be probably the ultimate sort of, you know, cherry on top of this ice cream sundae that I call my life. So I'm really hopeful that's going to happen.
That's awesome. So you're going to have one daughter each do one of your cataracts?
Yeah, I think that's fair. maybe one can do the cataract and one can do the YAG or something. I don't know. We'll see. But my practice has evolved in a way that we're kind of shifting a lot of our mindset of how we're operating, and you know, facilities are growing and changing. The big thing in our practice that I'm really kind of passionate about, you know, taking a step back, you know, we all went to this profession because we want to make an impact, and you know, and I don't think there's a better profession to do that, in my opinion. Sure. But you know, I my career sort of, I can kind of sum up in terms of, you know, obviously service to patients, commitment to education and teaching, like you've obviously taught billions of doctors around the world, you know, teaching other doctors, teaching other colleagues, teaching up and coming medical students, residents and fellows and so on and so forth. But also kind of, how do we make a bigger impact than we're making now? You know, we can only do so much by doing our part in our day-to-day life. How can we, you know, train? And so some things that I've been fortunate to be part of is obviously missions where we train other colleagues in other areas of the world to sort of continue to, you know, continue this process and sort of exponentially multiply. The other thing that we're thinking in terms of how to make impact even in our practices and our patients here today is kind of how the structure of our practices is what the direction is going, especially specifically with regards to operating suites and operating rooms. And the big passion that I think the last 2-3 years that I've been fortunate able to work with my administrator and my nephew, my partner, Neil Vadia, is we want to bring this idea of office-based surgery to our profession. It's already there, but it's a very, very low adoption rate at this point. There's a lot of barriers, you know, financial, regulatory, other things. And we want to try to build awareness of this because I think we are really kind of facing a big problem coming down the road in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. I mean, you know that the population's aging, the number of cataract surgeries are probably going to double, if not more. And I don't know that we have the infrastructure to be able to continue to do that many cases in the current settings that we have. The problem is that a lot of our hospitals are starting to, you know, not want to be involved in ophthalmic you know, delivery of eye care from their regulatory and financial, you know, issues. ASCs, which have been sort of over the last 20, 30 years, really are sort of safety valve in the majority of procedures that done in off ambulatory surgery centers. They are now also starting to feel like, well, you know, I can do, you know, one joint, you know, a hip replacement, and make, you know, $25,000 or $30,000 on profit versus 25 cataracts and in a much shorter time, much fewer, much smaller carbon footprint or fuel, whatever the case is. So we're actually finding ourselves marginalized so that we can't even find enough time to do the cases. And that's true, especially for younger surgeons, as we've had a few younger surgeons, you know, join our practice and come in. It's hard for them to have a place to be able to do surgery. And I think that problem is going to amplify and continue. And I think that, you know, when we started this project of having our office-based surgery suite built, and it's been now over a year and a half since we have it operational, it's been eye-opening. And it's almost something like, you know, I felt like I'd gone through just the motions, and I've had a very great career, and I've been very fortunate. But the last, you know, 25, 26 years of my practice, I felt like I was just kind of sleepwalking through this. And when I started doing cases in my office-based suite, it was eye-opening. It was like a renaissance. It was like a rebirth. I was so energized.
How so?
It's hard to explain today. I'll tell you, because, you know, obviously we do surgery. We do great results. We get patients are super happy. But there was always something kind of, two things that were kind of missing. And what I found that when I was able to do it in my own suite, and by the way, my office suite, I mean, it's beautiful. It's constructed well and very cost effectively. If people are wondering how to do that. You know, my partners and I, we started a company called Site Surgical to help people sort of develop office space and bring more awareness of this. So this kind of in its infancy, but you're going to hear a lot more about this. But when you walk into this suite, and it's in your office. So when you walk into this, it's not basically a spare room or a closet that you throw a microscope in and just start operating. This is a state-of-the-art mini ASC. I mean, it has all of the regulatory features that you need. The special flooring and the lighting and the HVAC exhaust and redundancies and the electrical system. It's built to an ASC standard, but just at a fraction of the footprint, fraction of the cost. So it's a beautiful space, you know, glass, you know, windows just to observe. So when we
How big is it? How many square feet?
It's about 1,400 square feet. And we have two ORs, which we're not using them yet. So, but we kind of built it as an extra space. You can do this probably around 1,000 square feet. If you have 1,000 square feet in your office, you can build state-of-the-art facility, which is so aesthetically pleasing, not only for us to go walk into, but the amazing thing is for patients. You know, patients see this as an extension of your office. They're walking in from, you know, one side of your office to the other. They know the staff. They feel so comfortable. You can do surgery, with the types of surgeries that we do, with very little anesthesia. You know, patients are much less anxious. It's an amazing experience for them. It's a boutique experience for them to have a procedure done in the office. I underestimated that. Our initial sort of impetus behind doing this was, you know, gosh, we're doing all these cases, these elective cases like ICLs and refractive lens exchanges, and the surgery centers are charging an arm and a leg for us to be able to go there and do these. And so it became cost prohibitive. So for us, it was more of a financial sort of thought process. I had no idea the other benefits that we would get from this. And that first benefit is that the patients just embrace this concept of having, it's like, you know, when you go to a dentist, you know, the same thing. You don't expect that the dentist can say, hey, we got to take out your tooth, or we got to put a crown. We're going to, hey, go to this hospital, you know, put change to a gown, get an IV, you know, you're going to be groggy. You know, it's you just walk in, it's a beautiful suite. You walk in, they make you comfortable. They do the procedure and you go home. And that's kind of the concept that we're doing here with the office-based surgery. So one thing is that the patients love it. The second thing is that it's so gratifying for me to be able to sort of, you know, walk into my own suite, do the case, have this patient go through this experience. That impacted me in a way that I had no idea that would happen. It was eye-opening for me. And now it's like, I love it when I have a case in the OBS, in the office-based suite, you know, and I'm like, I walk out of there, I'm like, oh, this is amazing. You know, and it's something you built with your own hands. And it's amazing. It's an amazing experience. So I think it's a win-win-win for everybody. From the patients to the staff to the surgeons, it's been great. And so I really want this to, you know, evolve so that the majority of practices right now, I think less than 1%, fewer than 1% of practices right now have an office-based suite. Now, there are a lot of areas in this country that have pretty good sort of, you know, looser requirements as far as building ASC, certificate of need requirements are waived and so on and so forth. And a lot of practices do have their own ASC. And I think for those docs, it's probably a very similar feeling to what I'm feeling. I just never had that. I mean, you know, in Illinois, which has been such a tight state as far as getting a certificate of need, I had always gone to the hospital or gone to the surgery center, never experienced this. I think many of my colleagues who probably have their own ASC, they feel this sense of ownership and pride, and they can create a boutique experience. They already know this. But for the majority of us who don't have access to that or cannot build an ASC, this is a way that we're trying to build it in a very small footprint, a mini ASC, to the highest standards. And why is it important? I think that eventually, as we get to this point where it's a perfect storm, where we've got all these patients that need surgery, there's nowhere to take them, and we are going to be faced with sort of what do we do? It's going to be an aha moment for us. And I think the government, you know, CMS, they're going to at some point say that this is a valid model and allow us to do surgery in an office-based setting. And I think within the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to see a big growth in that. And so we're trying to take the lead early on to get people set up, to get to a point where if we establish infrastructure now, we're not going to be scrambling to try to get this when sort of the time comes and we're pressed into action. Also, our feeling is that when this happens, you know, they're not going to allow us to just do surgery in any room with any old equipment. You're going to have a facility that has been made to a certain standard, not maybe the same as standard as an ASC. Maybe you don't need to have, you know, 20-foot wide hallways and male and female locker rooms and all these different stupid logistics, in my opinion, that are not applicable to an office-based system. And we've proven that concept, and we've been able to do cases very effectively. We did get certification from Quad A, so it's a certified facility. It's just not licensed by Medicare, because in Illinois we need to have a certificate of need. But once that changes, I think you're going to see that majority of patients are going to want to do surgery in this setting. You've been all over the world. You see this in other countries too. I mean, you know, the first time I went to India as an adult, probably, I don't know, 25 years ago, you know, I visited an ophthalmologist there, and, you know, he had his clinic on the first floor and his surgical suite on the second floor. And it was that model. And I saw that, and I said, why can't we do that here? And now, you know, 25 years later, I think it's becoming a reality. And I think that's kind of my next sort of passion, to be able to sort of bring this, and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. But I think that it's an idea whose time has come, and I think we're going to embrace it. Very similar to how, you know, when we started operating, it was all hospitals. Mm-hmm. There was a big pushback. Oh, you can't do surgery in an ambulatory setting. It's, you know, it's unsafe, and so on and so forth. And that was certainly proved wrong. And I think, you know, we'll do this the right way and prove that office-based surgery for our surgeries makes a tremendous amount of sense for all these reasons that I've just said.
So. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, going back to this, so 1,400 square feet. So for our non-U.S. friends, it's about 140 square meters, and it's 10-1.
I'll take your word for that. Stupid American. I don't have a metric system, right?
Well, I travel a lot. But that's one operating room or two?
So we have two rooms built out. We've only equipped one of them with the microscope and the phaco and everything else. But it's there. The potential is there to be able to have two. You can even use that for an eczema laser or a femto laser or something. You know, you can. There's a lot of uses for it. You have to have, you know, a little bit of a small waiting area. You have to have a pre-op and a post-op bay. You have to have obviously all of your clean room, your dirty room. You've got to have a little locker facility, you know, storage facility. So those are all things that kind of add up to that, you know, 1,400 square feet. It can be done a little smaller footprint if you only have one room, for example. I think about, you know, 1,000 square feet would certainly work. And so that's, you know, the bare minimum, I would think, in order to have a facility that can be potentially upgraded. At the end of the day, you've got to see how many patients, you know, you're going to want to run through this facility. And with our, you know, build out, it was as part of an expansion project for my office. So it kind of got built in, but I would say that the construction costs are pretty, you know, minimal, because you don't need a lot of stuff. The biggest expense, obviously, is equipment, and you can decide kind of what type of equipment you have. You know, we put the heads-up 3D display, you know, in there so we can operate it, you know, without using, you know, the oculars, and that's been great. I love doing that. And so we did put all the bells and whistles, and we made this a really state-of-the-art facility. But you can customize that, you know, how you want to do it. The big thing is, how many cases are you going to do? I don't think this will ever replace an ASC, certainly not in my practice, because the number of patients that we would have to run through there, it's just not feasible for a facility that small. But for now, it's actually really great because, you know, we were kind of running out of room in the ASC to do patients. And now if I take even 20% of my patients out and do them in the office, now I've got more room in the ASC without even adding more time or anything. And so it's been a good sort of balance. And I think that's kind of how it's going to be. I don't think office-based, you know, approaches are going to eliminate ASCs. I think a lot of ASC owners are concerned that might happen. I really don't think that's going to be the case. I think you've got enough surgeries out there and enough, you know, facilities that this is going to complement ASC. And we think that it can grow a practice as premium base, a premium offerings, because you are providing a really premium customer centric experience for them. And it just builds word of mouth, and it's really been a driver for us in terms of the number of premium products and procedures that we can do. So it's been tremendous.
In your office-based center here, your suite, you're able to do, let's say, phakic lenses, refractive lens exchange, but yep. it's hard to do these Medicare patients who are now, you're not going to get a facility fee for.
So that's the thing. So right now, you know, because we don't have a CMS licensed facility, because we don't have a certificate of need from the state, so on and so forth, we're not doing anybody who's Medicare age. Unless certain Medicare Advantage plans, you can contract with them and get a facility fee. So we're in the process of looking into that. We are able to also potentially contract with commercial payers, you know, your Blue Crosses and Aetnas, and you may be able to get a facility fee from them. There may be a process that you have to go through, but that's something that we're also looking into. But for now, you know, we thought that we would break even if we did, you know, 250 cases are in a, you know, at some point. And we thought maybe that might take us 2 years to do that. And within our first year, I think we did more than 400 cases. And so, and that's among four surgeons, you know, so it's certainly doable. And it's not high volume, but it's already kind of broken even. It's already paying dividends, and it's driving, like I said, adoption of premium products in our practice. So phakic IOLs for sure, very easy, very minimal equipment required, young, healthy patients. Refractive lens exchange, same thing. Typically younger patients, you do need, of course, phaco machine and that kind of setup. You can do other plastics procedures, for example, you can do that as well. And so the only thing that we're doing at this point, our certification is just a Class A certification for anesthesia. So we're only using oral medications and topical. We're not, we don't have a CRNA. We don't have an anesthesiologist present. So we just do monitoring of the patient pre and post and give them the oral sedative. Obviously, all our doctors are ACLS certified. I hope to God we never have to use that. But, right. But, you know, but we need to have those, you know, the systems in place. But it's very similar to if a patient, for example, had an event in your office. I mean, you would, you know, perform high quality CPR, call 911. It's really the same right. process. And so
what method are you giving for sedation then?
So I have kind of gone through a little bit of an evolution. We started using oral Valium initially. I felt that 5 or 10 milligrams, I felt that it took a little bit longer time to act. And then it would not wear off as quickly either. So it was kind of a little bit, I started using alprazolam or Xanax. That seemed to be a little better, 1 milligram. Started doing now just a little bit of, you know, 2 milligrams or Versed, the liquid under the tongue, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes before the procedure. And that seems to be very, very calming, very low risk of, you know, side effects. And patients, you know, have been responding pretty well. You know, for me, having started off, you know, doing cataract surgery, probably you as well, with retrobulbar anesthesia, you know, and patients kind of zonked out, you know, and I was told by one of my mentors that if a patient during cataract surgery even has a little bit of a fast twitch of any muscle, it would be disastrous. And so, you know, we would zonk these people out, and we would, you know, make them, you know, immobile completely. And that's how I was kind of trained 30 years ago. Surgery. Now, you know, obviously that was a leap to do topical anesthesia and not do retrobulbars. It was a leap for me, honestly, to be able to do something without IV sedation. And so, you know, the first the first case I ever did, I shouldn't say this, but the first case I ever did without any IV sedation was my daughter. I did her ICL surgery a couple of years ago. And so she did great and it was perfect. But the idea is that oral sedation is plenty. And now it was born out of necessity because in our hospitals and ASCs, we also had a problem with anesthesia shortages. And so they were saying that, well, you can't do as many cases as you're doing because you don't have an anesthesiologist. And so I said, well, I mean, I'll start doing them with just, you know, IV sedation, local. So now I just did, the other day I did in my ASC, in the ASC, I did, I think, you know, 19 or 20 cases in the morning and only one of them required monitored anesthesia care. Now, the other 18 of them were just, you know, 2 milligrams of Versed sublingual and they did amazing. And so we've gotten to the point now where our patients are not expecting to be zonked out. They don't need to be zonked out. They're for the most part, you have to select very well. But that was a barrier for us when we went into office-based surgery because, you know, how are we going to provide anesthesia? I don't have an anesthesiologist. I don't have a CRNA. Now, I will tell you that if you get busy enough and you get to the point where you're doing more complex cases, older patients, higher morbidities, you know, ASA class 3, 2, 3s, you know, right now we're limiting it to ASA class 1. But if you have somebody who needs surgery in your suite, you could also get to a state where you get class B certification. You can hire a CRNA to come in and do so. So this can be, you know, modular and it can evolve as your needs grow. Right now, as I said, we're doing young patients, healthy patients, elective things. Most of the things that we do are very, very manageable with oral medications. And so we haven't decided to go to the second level of certification, but it's all there. I mean, this is the future. I just don't see any other way for us to be able to continue to offer the number of procedures that we currently do, unless the ASCs, you know, get bigger and add more rooms and add more staff, which they're not going to do. Mm-hmm. I just think that we're facing a perfect storm where we are going to have problems in the next 5 years. And I think this is a way to maybe alleviate a little bit of that.
Oh, makes a lot of sense. Now, you have 4 surgeons in your group. We're using this place. So are you running it then 5 days a week or 4 days a week? How?
Yeah, typically I would say it's been sort of, you know, we can do cases whenever we want. And that's the beauty of it too, by the way, patients. I used to tell patients who needed an elective, maybe an ICL, my next appointment's in, you know, 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't really go very well. And now since we've had an office-based option, you know, I can do surgery. Hey, you come in for a consult today. You want surgery 2 days from now? Sure, we'll do it 2 days from now. And so we have a built-in staff. We hired our director of our office-based suite is a young woman who's had thousands and thousands of eyes under her belt as a scrub tech. So she works with us in the OR. She also manages actively everything. And we trained some of our technicians, our senior technicians, who are always assisting us in the office in LASIK and SMILE and those kinds of things. We converted them to being, you know, office-based circulators. And so we have a built-in team. If I, you know, within reason say, hey, I want to operate 2 days from now, I can just say I'm going to add a case on and we do it. So we have a lot of flexibility. I would say that we probably, again, we did probably 400 cases our first year. You know, you figure on an average, probably 3 to 3 days or 4 days a week, we would do, you know, 1 or 2 cases a day.
It's the same staff that's in your clinic.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all our circulators are all our technicians and other staff. The only one we added was our office-based surgery manager. Because we needed a scrub tech. We didn't have, I mean, most ophthalmology practices don't have a scrub tech. So we hired her to run the operation and do all the surgeries with us. And so she's been great. And I think in the future, as we add more cases, we may add another one. But she for now is the only one doing it, and it's been great.
No, it's fantastic. Yeah, it makes sense if you have multiple surgeons in the group who can use the facility.
Yeah.
I think the tougher part of the solo guy, it's just a little bit
tougher. Yeah, no, I agree. There's a balance for sure. There's no question, you know, we're fortunate to have, you know, a number of surgeons who can operate and use the facility. You know, it would take a lot longer for one person to sort of recoup, unless this becomes their primary, you know, location where they're doing cases. Now, if you have a state where you can do, I've gotten plenty of, you know, requests for information and for assistance with our company that we started for people who are starting a solo practice and they want to build an office-based suite for themselves. It may not be 1,400 square feet. It might be smaller. And depending on what number of volume of cases they want to do, it still may make sense. I mean, we're talking about cost-wise a fraction, you know, probably, you know, a tenth of what, you know, an ASC would cost. And so, you know, you can make this, the finances make sense if you have, in the beginning, if you have a lot of premium cases, it makes a lot of sense. Once you get to the point where insurances start to pay facility fee and or you do, you know, Medicaid, then it's a no-brainer. Then you do as many cases as you can there because you're getting the benefit. And again, this is something that people who have practices in states where they have their own ASC, they know this for years. It's just that I never was fortunate enough to be able to be in a state like that.
Right. Yeah, and our setup is we have a surgery center, an ASC, large, six operating rooms, and we have many ophthalmologist partners. And so it's a dedicated, the entire ASC is just ophthalmology.
Correct. No, it's a great setup. I don't know if a new doctor comes in the area, can they find time to operate? You're probably all very busy. I mean,
it can be tough.
And as your volumes grow, where are we going to go? And I think that's why I think you need something like this. In certain instances, it makes a lot of sense. Now you can maybe expand your ASC if you have room or the footprint to do that. But that's not true for majority of them.
No, I mean, you're right. Because actually, our same business, we had a different location with three operating rooms before. Then we moved to the new center. Now we've got six operating rooms. And you know what? We could probably expand it even more.
And if you build it, they will come. I mean, the patients are there. I mean, you know the number. You know the statistics. I mean, we're going to be drowning here very soon in Canada. We're not increasing the number of, you know, residency slots. Obviously, we talked about how competitive it was. And I think somebody said that only about 60 or 65% of the applicants match this year. So that either means that there's too few slots or too many applicants, I guess. And it just, I think it's going to be a growing problem as we go, you know, forward. I don't know if there was an impact where with COVID, did a lot of, you know, upper, you know, senior ophthalmologists end up retiring. We're seeing that a little bit in our area now, trickling down effect over the last few years where some of the older solo practitioners are just sort of dropping off, or even maybe they're not completely retired, but they're not doing as many cases anymore. And that's kind of the natural evolution anyway. And I think you may have new people coming in to fill that gap, but I think we're going to run out of surgeons and run out of facilities. And I think that's where this sort of idea came about. And it's been a fun journey to see this go from, you know, theoretically paper on paper to now actually in practice. And now I want to scale it to the next level and help other practices do this. And so this is kind of where I want to spend a little bit of the next few years. I mean, you know, whatever I've got left in this profession, I want to try to continue to make an impact at home, you know, with my patients. I want to try to do as much outreach as I can by going on, you know, missions and doing things like that. And this is another area where I think we can make an impact for the greater good of our society and ophthalmology specifically. So,
yeah, I mean, you were saying one of our challenges, the number of ACGME approved residency spots is very low. I think it was recently expanded a little bit, but still somewhere in the 500 range for the whole country per year.
Yeah,
so you're only graduating basically 500 ophthalmologists a year for the whole country.
And I believe
they're smarter. The younger generation is smarter than us. They don't want to do the 80-hour work weeks we used to do all the time.
Well, that's an issue too. I mean, yeah, you've seen that. We're seeing that a lot as we're trying to build, you know, this incoming crew of younger doctors. And it's a different, we're going to have to adapt. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure our predecessors kind of called us, you know, lazy, and we didn't want to do things that they did. Well, I, you know, walked uphill, you know, both ways to school in the snow.
I don't think they're lazy. I think they're smart. I think there's more to life than just working.
I think we have to adapt. I think that's where we're seeing it as we're building this next, you know, growth of our practice, is that we're going to have to adapt. And it's not, you know, it's not your father's ophthalmology practice, quite literally. You know, for my daughter, it won't be her dad's ophthalmology practice. It'll be something different. It'll evolve just like everything evolves, I think, hopefully for the better. And if we keep adapting and take that into consideration as we are hiring these younger folks and make it a place where, you know, they want to come to work, maybe not every day, but they want to come to work. But if they come to work and be productive and grow the business and give back, I mean, and be fulfilled in their life. You know, I agree that you know, obviously we, you know, we value our families and we value our time and our hobbies and everything else too. And that balance is certainly more emphasized these days. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think we have to sort of just make it work for everybody.
Yeah, I think we're gonna get there. But I'm really amazed. Next time I'm in Chicago, I can come visit. I got
to
come.
Oh, I'd love to have you come by. Absolutely. Please do. I'd love to have you see it.
Yeah, that's really a surprisingly small amount of space. I didn't think you'd get two operating rooms and just 1,400 square feet, which is really quite efficient.
Yeah, it is. It really is efficient. I mean, and you can see, like, you know, how hospital systems are so inefficient, right? And right. ASCs are much, much
better.
More efficient. But I think this is even more efficient because, again, it's how much more efficient can it be? You have a center, you walk into it, you do your surgery in 1 second, you can see a patient, you know, and then you can kind of go right back and do another surgery. I mean, I first saw this when I interviewed with Dick Lindstrom up at Minnesota Eye for fellowship, and I saw him walk into one room and do a LASIK, walk in the next room, do a cataract, walk in the next room and talk to a patient about signing up for cataract or something. So it was like a carousel. He just went from one room to the other, and I thought, this is amazing. This is such an efficient way to operate. And then for the next 30 years, I've been basically doing things very, very much in a primitive way compared to that. And now I think we're hopefully kind of getting back towards that a little bit. And I think that helps. Efficiency is really important, especially if we're going to have to do more, you know, cases, and there's going to be, you know, fewer of us, you know, doing it. I think efficiency is the name of the game for sure.
Are you also doing your cornea cases there, like a, you know, DMX or?
No, I think it's feasible. It's just the other issues, regulatory issues are number one. Most of these patients are older, so they're Medicare, so I can't officially do a case there. Second thing is, you know, all the reimbursement with, you know, tissue. Pass through and who's going to pay for it, and that's cost prohibitive. I have some of the ASCs that I operate won't accept cornea, you know, DMET cases because they don't feel like they can get reimbursed for the tissue. So that's another area we have to kind of figure out how this is going to work. But I have no doubt that I could do any surgery that I do, if it's even like a secondary IOL or a complex AC reconstruction. I could do anything in my office-based suite if I had the certification approval by CMS, if I had, you know, the right equipment, and the anesthesia, I would have no doubt that facility can do anything. It's just a question of how much are we going to push it and how much do we need to push it? You know, I mean, if we can still do some of those complex things in a hospital or ASC, that's what I'm going to continue to do as long as I'm allowed to. And this is a great safety valve. It just kind of allows for us to siphon off some of the patients. And like I said, there's benefits for everyone. There's no question.
So you have multiple locations for your practice. So this is just in one of the locations then, like your
Yeah, right. As of now, correct. So we have two main offices, and we have a satellite downtown Chicago at Rush Medical College, Rush University, where we're all on staff and faculty. So we have the two locations out of them. One of them has this facility that we built. Eventually, I think if we, you know, take this concept to the second facility, we could do that. And as we expand, I think that's definitely in the cards. The other area that I think we're seeing a lot of, sort of momentum in ophthalmology is consolidation of practices. So it could be a situation where, you know, if we, you know, consolidate a few practices, we might have other surgeons who could potentially come and use the facility as well. Right now, we're limiting it just to our own surgeons from, you know, medical legal perspective. It's just, we're not having it as an open access facility. But, you know, if we get to a point where we consolidate a few practices, now we have even more surgeons who can drive more revenue through there. And so it's definitely a situation where then you could say, well, let's build one in another location. So it's again, the convenience of it. So there's room for growth. We just need to kind of take it one step at a time and continue the process.
Where do you think we're going with all that practice consolidation? I think that's kind of slowed down a little bit.
I think it slowed down. I think I'm not an expert in, you know, private equity, but I think that we've seen that appetite go down a little bit. Obviously, it's been very expensive. Money's been very expensive the last few years. And so I think that helped drive that little bit of, you know, slowdown. We're not seeing the valuations the money that was being thrown at people. And I don't know, I would say, I don't know what your experience is, but, you know, probably about 50% of the people who have gone through private equity, you know, transactions are happy, and probably 50% are not so happy. And I think there's probably, you know, some obviously there's some give and take. And I don't know if it's for the better or not. I think depending on the stage of your career, you know, it may make sense. Other stages, it may not make sense. And so beyond that, though, what I'm talking about is not some entity coming in and buying up people and running it. I think we could do this ourselves. I mean, we're smart people. We could definitely get a group together and consolidate a few practices that are maybe geographically kind of complementary, or maybe complementary in terms of the ages of the surgeons, and have a situation where, well, if we combine our forces together, we can have economies of scale as far as our our back office, you know, our contracting can be, you know, that's a big issue that we can't, as an individual practice, have any impact on contracting with these payers. I mean, we're nobody. And then, but if you have a bigger group, if you have, you know, 10x your EBITDA, you know, now you've got some power, and you can make an impact that way too. So I think that's probably where things might go in the future, but it's a tricky road to navigate. But I think these types of things lend itself well to having, you know, a facility that can be used by those groups and do surgeries there. Because I think, as I said, it's all going to boil down to kind of, you know, access to surgery. I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see that.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. Like in my own clinic, it was such a game changer to have excimer laser and femtosecond laser for corneal refractive surgery right in the clinic.
Oh, sure.
Well, that was a game changer.
I remember having to go to an ASC to where the first one was in 1997 or whatever. I had to go drive. Hey, meet me there. I'll do your LASIK and then we'll come back. And then we got one in our office and it was like, this is amazing. This is kind of what I'm saying. This is kind of to the next level now. We do all these amazing things with ICLs and lenses and, you know, the type of, you know, vision we can give patients now in minutes. And it's amazing. It's so blessed to have this, you know, opportunity to be part of this. And so it's been a fun journey.
You must separate out then the real squirrely patients or the ones who are not so healthy, and then kind of those will be ASC based. And
absolutely, I mean, I've gotten good and we've gotten better because we don't really pay attention to that before, right? So now little things kind of tip you off and say this person may not be a good candidate for.
Tell me what are those things. I don't know.
Well, you know, first I will tell you that, you know, we just become more observant, right? So, you know, sometimes you go to put a drop in a patient's eye and they start, you know, kind of flinching, you know, that may be a good sign that maybe they're a little bit, you know, because it doesn't hurt to put an eye drop in, but that's their personality. And then certain things that they say, certain behaviors, I'll tell you the number one driver for me is my coordinator. Because, you know, all these patients will go and talk to the coordinators about scheduling and they have the final decision saying, you know, this person's a little kind of off their rocker, you know, because they spend more time with them, they know than we spend. Yeah. So they're a pretty good judge. And we've had a very good track record where some, you know, my coordinators say, well, this person definitely is not an office space or not even an oral sedation candidate for the ASC. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure they're, you know, zonked out. So they use your staff because they will, you know, hear things and see things. They spend more time with the patients than you do to kind of figure out these things. But you have to pick the right patients because otherwise it can be, you know, tricky. You can supplement, you know, anesthesia orally with a little Versed if you have to, if something, you know, really gets, you know, if there's, God forbid, there's any kind of, we haven't had any complications, but let's say there's a complication and it's a longer procedure, the patient's getting a little more agitated. You know, we have protocols in place where we can give them additional, you know, sublingual anesthesia and get through the case if need be. But again, it's all about patient selection for the beginning. Find the right slam dunk cases, you know, and it's very successful.
And you're not even keeping them, you know, empty stomach. You're not keeping them NPO even.
No, they can eat whatever they want. You know, obviously we don't recommend that they, you know, eat a steak before they come in, but they can have a light meal before they come in. If it's early in the morning, they can have a cup of coffee and they can, because we're really, honestly, the amount of anesthesia that they're getting is so low, so low. And as paradoxically, they're probably less anxious about the whole process anyway. Obviously they're a little nervous, but it's not an unfamiliar environment. They're not walking into a hospital or surgery center and saying, oh my God, I'm having, it's that whole mental thing. So they actually need less anesthesia than I think that we're giving them. On the whole, if you look at the average, you know, amount of meds being pushed in a cataract surgery, there's a new anesthesiologist or a new CRNA comes into the room, they've never been worthy before, and I forget to tell them, I usually like to use maybe a milligram of Versed at the most. That's all I ever use, even through the IV, and they come in and they're zonked out. And how did you give them? Well, I gave them 3 milligrams, and I gave them fentanyl. I gave them, I'm like, what? So much stuff. I mean, this is not, we're not doing anything. But so I always tell them, hey, start with a milligram. If they need more, give them a little more. I don't like these patients to be sort of knocked out. And so that's kind of where, now some need it, no question. But then the most majority, I think as a whole, we are giving too much anesthesia for these types of surgeries.
Well, I'm like you. I use an anesthesiologist, work with the same one almost every week, and it's 1 or 2 milligrams of Versed. That's it.
Perfect. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's supposed to,
if we can just do that sublingual like you're doing, maybe not even have the IV in.
But that, I think that's, I mean, so the, what, you know, the IV, you know, the people that balk at the not having an IV is like, oh, what if they have, You know, what if they go into arrest? Well, okay, look, I mean, so if an anesthesiologist is there, yes, that's a valid point. In your own facility, I mean, if they go into arrest, I'm calling 911. I mean, I'm starting CPR, you know, ACLS, and then calling that. I don't need to have IV access. And if I have got, and I could probably put an IV in if I had to, in a pinch, if I had to. So I don't really think we need IVs. And I think that level of anxiety goes way down when you're not putting in IVs. You just have patients come in, they get their drops, they get a little sublingual, and they're good to go.
No, I think that sounds great. My advice
for people kind of getting into that, or if they're faced with an anesthesia shortage, is just to do that. Is to start picking the right patients who are kind of calm personalities to begin with, no major morbidities, and start with a little 2 milligrams sublingual Versed, and that's it. And they're being monitored in the room. You know, your nurse will have them hooked up to the monitor just to make sure the pulse ox is okay and all that.
So you're basically doing pulse oximetry as you're monitoring.
Pulse. Yeah, I mean, I don't. It's the same machine in the AS. Oh, in my office, yes. Yeah. But it's in the same in the ASC. It's the same machine that they have set up for the anesthesia. They'll just put a pulse ox on, and I don't think they put a heart rate. A EKG monitor. I think they just put the pulse ox, which just does their heart rate and O2 sat, and that's it. And maybe blood pressure they check before the case. That's it.
So then you don't even have an anesthesiologist in the room or CRNA in the room. It's just you.
Nobody went in the ASC when we do. So my evolution was that, you know, I had two rooms and I was able to crank through patients. Yeah. They said, well, we only have one room now for you because we don't have an anesthesiologist for the second room. They had the staff to do the surgery. I said, well, let's just keep two rooms. I'll do one room as, you know, IV sedation and one room is just oral sedation. No anesthesiologist. So in that room, they have a circulator and they have one person just watching the monitor. And then they have the scrub tech and myself. So there's four people. In the other side of the other room, there's the CRNA or the anesthesiologist and then the circulator and that. So there's no CRNA in those rooms where, because they just have a shortage. Now, sometimes if I need it, they'll go back and forth and kind of help out. But majority of patients, I said the other day, I mean, I literally, one patient needed, was scheduled under MAC. Everybody else was oral sedation. The other 18 out of 19 cases were just fine with oral sedation. It's really amazing how, but that, believe me, that was a leap for me a couple of years ago to do that. And then the first time I ever did that, as I said, was like, oh, this is, you know, eye-opening because now we don't necessarily have to be limited by not having anesthesia staff around. We can still do cases. So that's something that's been, it's been definitely, and we see this now pretty widespread in our area because of the fact that there's been this shortage of providers. So most ophthalmologists now are doing all just oral and topical drops and they do great. So that's an easy evolution to the office-based, you know, the office-based suite in healthy patients and uncomplicated, you know, cases.
Yeah, I should try that. Then it's like the next step is just, it's the identical situation. Just do it in your suite.
Well, I would tell you, you know, yeah, exactly. And so if for people kind of starting out, you know, maybe do everything the same, but just have your staff, if you want to put in, I mean, if the rules are that you have to put an IV in, put an IV in, but then tell the anesthesiologist, hey, just give them 2 milligrams of oral sublingual and see, like a little under the tongue, and don't give them any IV and see how they do. And you'll see that we will not skip a beat. This will be, I mean, exactly the same procedure. And then you remove the IV and then you remove the anesthesiologist. And that. And
what's the absorption when you do the sublingual? How quickly does it take effect? Like, I know when they push the IV versus that, it's like 30 seconds.
That's seconds. This is probably 10, 15 minutes, I would say. Most of the time they get it kind of right 5-10 minutes, maybe before they're being wheeled back. So that's about 10 minutes, I bet. It's pretty fast. It's that sublingual little slurry that they give them. When I used to give the, and I still do my office, sometimes I give them the tablet, the Xanax tablet, that's about 30 minutes. So I'll give it to them about 30 minutes before. And then if they need a second one, I'll give them a second one, maybe 10 minutes. But if they're still feeling a little anxious, I'll give them a second. But with the Versed, it's been pretty one dose of Versed is usually enough, 2 milligrams sublingual. And you know, I think they, I can confirm, but I think they give it about 10, 15 minutes before the procedure and they're good.
Are you using the small, like, you know, Statum sterilizer that you use for LASIK, or are you using like a big sterilizer? How are you doing all this?
In my office based?
Yeah.
Boy, I don't remember the name of the sterilizer, but it's similar to the one we have for LASIK. It's probably a Statum, but I don't know exactly the name, but it's not super big. It's a, you know, good unit. It works well. And it's adequate for what we need.
Well, can I ask, what was your total startup cost on this? Because you got a build out. You've got all the equipment you got to buy. You've got your instruments you got to buy. You're using a heads up display. You're looking at half a million dollars more.
Yeah, about a half. I would say that, you know, our construction costs, you know, again, it was built in, it was kind of tied into a project that we were doing in the same suite. We were expanding our suite. So this was just part of the expansion. So it's hard to estimate exactly attributable to that suite. But I would say that the cost was less than maybe $150 a square foot. So maybe about $200,000 for build out costs, I would say. I would say including your HVAC and all that kind of stuff, the tiles and the lighting and all that. Equipment, now we went with, you know, the heads-up display and the FACO and all that sort of stuff, the microscope and whatnot. So that probably cost about $250, I want to say, maybe a little bit over $200. And then, you know, so we're talking about maybe I would say about $500,000, you know. So all in, you know, $500,000. The equipment's the biggest cost, obviously, you know, but you can recoup your build out costs, you know, like I said, pretty easily. We were expecting about 200 to 250 cases to break even. Because if you figure on average, you know, let's say you're doing an ICL or premium kind of thing. Let's say you're getting about $1,000 additional profit per eye. So about $200,000 is what we were expecting to have a break even for that.
Yeah, if you do the math, instead of paying a facility fee to the surgery center for all these.
I was paying $1,800 an eye for an ICL and an RLE.
Wow.
Including anesthesia, including whatever. And for RLE, maybe it makes sense. It doesn't. But maybe it does because you got the FACO, you got the tubing. You got
that all includes the IOL?
No, it doesn't include the IOL. It's just the facility fee and the anesthesia.
Wow.
And so for ICL, it makes no sense because I don't even use a FACO machine. I don't use any equipment. I use a couple of vials of one vial of viscoelastic and a couple of syringes for BS. So they were charging me $1,800 for that. So immediately that's a profit of, you know, $3,600 if you're doing two eyes. And God forbid the ICL rotates or you have to change it or something. Now it's another $1,800. And so then pretty soon you're paying the patient to have surgery. And so that was kind of my initial impetus to do this. Right. But, you know, as I said, it's evolved now so that it's such an amazing experience for everyone. It's been great. But no, that's where the cost kind of savings come in. And, you know, to the point where we started doing some premium cases, like, you know, if we do a light adjustable or multifocal for a commercial cataract patient, you know, we're not getting a facility fee right now because we don't have all our contracts in place with the commercials. But, you know, let's say, you know, you make it up a little bit on the fee that you're charging for your premium services. And so it's a little bit of a loser there in terms of that. But the value that you're getting in terms of the brand building of your practice, your office-based suite, boutique experience. Yeah, the experience. It's a little bit of and we don't do a lot of those cases, but that's also a good way to sort of, you know, drive a little bit of revenue there. And it's been an amazing, you know, it's been about a year and a half that we started doing cases. And it's exceeded our expectations already. It's been great. And it's just beginning. It's really just scratching the surface.
I think it makes a lot of sense when you have multiple surgeons there, because if you have a solo person using it a half day a week, kind of sits empty for 80% of the time, not ideal.
Well, you know, the nice thing about it is that, you know, what are your costs? Basically, it's just the space cost, right? I mean, equipment's right. Cost the same. Your space is there. Your staff can be repurposed. So, like I said, we don't have a full-time staff. You know, most of the staff that's there are doing other things in your clinic already. And our office-based manager, if she's not working in the office-based suite as a scrub tech or ordering or planning or whatever else, we have her helping out in other areas of the clinic as well, too. So, I mean, she's there as a full-time employee doing stuff in our office. So, we've you know, been able to utilize that. So it's not as much of a dead zone as you think, although it is. I mean, certainly we're not using it, you know, 8 hours a day.
So if you're paying rent, obviously the rent 4 days a week may not be used. But I guess I like your idea of repurposing the office staff, so which also means that when you're doing procedures there, you're not also seeing patients. So you're not doing the model you were saying earlier, which is like see a consult, do a surgery, do a LASIK, see a consult.
We I mean, as volume, I don't have the volume to do that, right? So yeah. I might operate 3 days a week in the office space. I might do one case here, one case there. So I don't need to necessarily build that in. But eventually, if we have a situation where we could, it's designed in a way that I could go see a patient, go do a case, come back, see a patient, do a case. I could go back and forth if I had to.
Cool.
If there's enough volume there, we have the staff to do that. And so it may get to that point someday. We're not there yet. And then I think it'll grow as time goes on. But even to your point about a solo, I know a lot of people, like I said, who are in solo practice and building practices where they're looking to do this, because imagine if a solo practitioner does 100 ICLs a year, okay? If you're doing 100 patients a year and you're saving $3,000 a patient, that's real.
Yeah,
that's real money right there, right? And so that adds up pretty fast. So even if the thing sits empty for the rest of the time, it's probably worth considering just from the standpoint of having that ICLs. And you know that you're not going to only do your ICLs there. You're going to do other stuff. If you are in a practice like ours where you have premium lenses and RLEs and other maybe plastics or something, it's going to be it can be utilized. And so
oculoplastics, whatever.
If you're spending $5 to $8 million building an ASC, you don't want that thing to sit empty. You're right. Spending $500,000, and you're making money on it already. It's not as big of an issue to have it sit empty. Ideally, I get it. It'd be nice for us to be able to, you know, use it more than we're using, and we will get there. But this is sort of the starting of it.
Well, I had a great hour primer here, learning all about office-based surgery, which is something I really didn't know enough about. So I'm really very appreciative. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, man. I look back at the list of people you've had on here. It's been the who's who of ophthalmology, you know, from your first podcast with Bobby Osher to all the amazing, brilliant people that we get to call friends. So as I said, this has been an amazing opportunity for me to be on this podcast. And it's been an amazing experience for me in my career so far. And I'm just blessed for all of it.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. I learned so much by doing this. Like, I literally just sat here.
I can imagine.
I learned so much.
And thanks for everything you do. I mean, it's amazing to see, you know, the impact you're having on people. The funny story, I ran into you somewhere in Colombia, I think, and I could not get two words in with you without having 1,000 people come by. And can I take a picture with you, Dr. Devgan? And you are a rock star celebrity. And I was just like, this is fantastic. You've done a great job, my friend, and keep it up. And proud to call you a friend.
Oh, thank you so much, Prague. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new podcast every single Sunday. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and where you get your podcast services. You find the Counter Coach Podcast. Of course, we have a new Counter Coach video every single day. We're at video 2,500. Can you imagine that? And of course, now we have RetinaRounds.com, a new retina video every single day. Check it out and subscribe. And so till next time, I'll check you later.